Renegade Broadcasting. Good evening. All here with brave hearts and moral courage, or those on the journey that get that way, know you are not alone. It's Wednesday, Bridget reading from the Tribune. Owner, operator, proprietor is Kyle Hunt, depending on supporter contributions. It's the 8th of March, and wouldn't you know, International Women's Day. I celebrated it by catching up with the shows archived at RBN of my international female lawyer, and found out she was widowed on February 12th. And wouldn't you know, luckily, just in time, today at Renegade was posted, Tricksters of the Globalist Sisterhood, my first reading. It's written by C-A-L-L-W-E-N, Cowen. Quote, the power of women is the powder keg of our time. The Aquarian Conspiracy by Marilyn Ferguson, S-R-I, Tavistock. In the promo video for an annual global sisterhood meditation, women of many races speak dreamily about the rise of the feminine and peace beyond borders. It coincides with International Women's Day, March 8th, which has merged women's advancement in general to the anti-white diversity agenda. One creepy thing you might notice in videos like this for International Women's Day is that there are no little white girls. And posted there is that particular video. Does the sisterhood include white girls like me, is the question. The feminine, straight out of Tavistock. The globalist's relentlessly lopsided emphasis on the feminine is strategic, to strike at the heart of tradition, family, and even biological instincts. It also furthers the white genocide agenda. Those in the know see the strategy here of using women, many of them well-meaning, to unite beyond the identities of ethnicity, nation, region. The theme for the Global Sisterhood Meditation this year is supporting refugees. Even as European sisters are facing rape, tragic loss of culture, and even murder from the refugee invasion. This is malevolent in the age of white genocide. There is no moral high ground here, only kind-hearted dupes and their globalist handlers. I used to be one of these women, so I know it's partly being naive, heavily programmed with the anti-white diversity agenda, and having Aryan compassion. It's a spiritual twist on the Jewish CIA feminist strategy of enlisting white women in the fight against the patriarchy, i.e. white men and European culture in general. With events like this, they take it global. The Dalai Lama, CIA funded, once said European women would save the world. And it could happen if only our sisters would wake up to the agendas they're unwittingly promoting and stand with our men against tyranny. They pose as humanitarians and have the money to make it look artistic, but the truth is, globalism is an unnatural plan to slow or direct kill most of us and enslave the rest. It purposelessly destroys unique cultures tied to the land. Thus, is a catastrophe for the natural world and creates the rootless, powerless slaves the perpetrators want. Hey, sister, do you really want to be part of that? Now, let's look at some of the agents that expose the globalist hands. The white race is the cancer of human history. Unify the global sisterfy. And you can see that video also. Wicked Sisters of the JWO. As I'll explain in another article, the feminine, when used by synonym of Jewish feminism, might also be a euphemism for the Jewish male. And many featured global sisters of note are known Psywar agents, or like Susan Sontag, are notorious anti-whites, not to mention being linked to the spirit cooker herself, Marina Abramović, counted herself a close friend to Sontag, and is on the board of the Susan Sontag Foundation. Other notable, quote, sisters featured are Eve Ensler, Joanna Macy, CIA, and NPR's Amy Goodman, Ford Foundation / CIA. One of the few European sisters featured is Jane Goodall, who Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. The other, Laurie Anderson, collaborated with one of those big guys, William Burroughs, CIA. The partners are who's who in the Judaic Masonic Order, like the UN's Pathway to Peace, founded by Avis Madison, Club of Budapest, and Robert Mueller. Mueller was Secretary General of the UN for 40 years and is considered the father of one world education and philosophy. He promoted the top-down imposition of education and even spirituality because, it seems, having survived the two wars, he didn't trust organic culture of towns, regions, nations. Mueller used the global warming scam to push for Earth government and also said this, quote, "We have brought the world together as far as we can politically. To bring about a true world government, the world must be brought together spiritually. What we need is a United Nations of religions," end of quote. Other partners for the Global Sisterhood Meditation are World Pulse, USAID CIA, and Woman to Woman, founded by Zionaire Mike Bloomberg, whose Bloomberg Philanthropies board has sisters on the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations. Then there's listed International Women's Day partners. This sisterhood is corporate sponsored. AECOM, European Bank, Caterpillar, Vodafone, MetLife, Western Union, PepsiCo, Avon. Trickster sisters. If we consider that the Aquarian conspiracy came out of the globalist Tavistock, considered the beating heart of mass mind control, we can see then and now its overemphasis on the feminine and its use as a social disruptor to make society more fluid and changeable, as per the Tavistock goals. In an interesting short video on the Tavistock agenda, Iona Miller writes, "Tavistock embodies the shadow of the shadow government, the trickster of our collective unconscious." And later she writes, "The Tavi's shadow unconsciously does more than it knows or admits, trickster effect." What's wild is that Iona Miller herself was outed by ex-husband Dr. Richard Allen Miller as a CIA spin writer. He calls her the icicle of Isis, the goddess. The point is, we have to wise up to the female tricksters that are active agents of the globalist, using the natural compassion of our people against us. Sisterhood is natural. How do we wake up European sisters, like those running this event, that they are unwitting agents in the destruction of their own folk? I woke up, and I know several others who have spoken the spell, but it does take thinking critically. I know others, though, who are doubling down on the New Age mantra that we are all one. It means educating yourself about social engineering and coming to terms with globalist agents and their goals. You have to walk through disillusionment when you realize women you looked up to are agents of deception. I know I did. Also, there's this idea that girls and women have become catty, judgmental, basically bitchy, and we have to come together and join hands and sing Kumbaya. Classic problem, reaction, solution, as many of the nasty hats of mean girls has come from crap programming. In closing, I'll say, I spent years in women's circles and think it's a powerful thing, but not when it's synthetic and has an agenda behind it. And whatever imbalance we've come to with the masculine and feminine, a lot of that is from the imposition of Semitic, Abrahamic values in the first place. Sisterhood is not something out of reach. It's instinctual and happens naturally when traditions and family life is whole and thriving. I know I wouldn't have made it without my own younger sister and the good friends I've had along the way. But if you look around at a circle orchestrated by globalists, the sisters are wearing the mask of the trickster. We can have real sisterhood if we wake up to these crimes against human consciousness, white genocide, and the plans for one world government. And then there's another video that you can watch. These are only a few plaintive examples from a huge number. So, thank you. Now, as I think everybody listening knows, this month is named after Mars, the Roman god of war, as well as the guardian of agriculture. Well, what I'd like to ask him to do is use his war powers and guard agriculture by warring against Monsanto, chemtrails, etc., etc. Thanks, Mars. Please listen. But first, my next one is outside the Tribune that I'm going to read. Is so what is a limited hangout civil war founded Video Rebel blog, which is vidrebel.wordpress.com, to those who don't know, on February 27th. But first, I'm going to go over the lyric of the anti-war song for anti-Vietnam War. You can find it mainly popularized on YouTube, by the way, if you want to sing along sometime with him, Edwin Starr. And it was written by two men that later ended up in Motown. One was born in 1942 and died in 2003. And the other name I'll need to get for it was Norman Whitfield. He was born 1940 and died 2008. Please excuse me. And the other one, as far as I can tell, is still alive. And Edwin, born in 1942 in Nashville, Tennessee, he died in England in 2003. And here it goes. War. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. War. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. Yeah. War. Good God. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Listen to me. War. I despise because it means destruction of innocent lives. War means tears to thousands of mothers' eyes. When their sons go to fight and lose their lives, I said, war, good God, y'all, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. War, whoa, Lord, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Listen to me. War, it ain't nothing but a heartbreaker. War, friend only to the undertaker. Oh, war is an enemy to all mankind. The point of war blows my mind. War has caused unrest within the younger generation. Induction, then destruction. Who wants to die? Oh, war! Good God, y'all, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it, say it, say it again. War! Yeah, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Listen to me. War, it ain't nothing but a heartbreaker. War, it's got one friend, that's the undertaker. Oh, war has shattered many a young man's dreams, made him disabled, bitter, and mean. Life is much too short and precious to spend fighting wars these days. War can't give life. It can only take it away. Oh, war. Good God, y'all. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. War. Oh, Lord. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Listen to me. War. It ain't nothing but a heartbreaker. War. Friend only to the undertaker. Peace, love, and understanding. Tell me, is there no place for them today? They say we must fight to keep our freedom, but Lord knows there's got to be a better way. Oh, war! God, y'all, what is it good for? You tell me. Say it, say it, say it, say it. War! Good God, y'all, what is it good for? Stand up and shout it. Nothing. Damn truth. By the way, I also started today before I caught up with my international lawyer. She lives in Panama. She left the United States, was the placed her on a terrorist list, all because she tried to turn in a pharmaceutical company trying to get money from a bank when the company wasn't worth it, wasn't worth any money. So, and that was, and it was a couple of weeks ago here, how the left killed the anti-war movement. So that song is now in the past. All right. Getting to Video Rebel. If you don't know him like I know him, I really, really recommend him to you. He also has a whole, I have to pull him up again. He also, by the way, has a whole set of, oh my God, on and on and on, of proof that Israel did 911. That's why we're doing all these wars on and on and on. So reading from him, his latest. So what is a limited hangout civil war? Catherine Austin Fitz told Greg Hunter that Wall Street stole $50 trillion from us. So What do you think will happen when the dollar dies and tens of millions of people come demanding their pensions and savings? When I was still in high school, I predicted the rise of the national security state. I based my analysis on the fact that Wall Street was robbing us blind. The bankers needed an all-powerful central government in Washington to make us sit down and shut up. In the second phase of this operation, the people who own the government in Washington intensified things by blowing up buildings with Americans inside. That happened to be 1993, 1995, and 2001. Bought and paid for Congress through the Patriot Act and through laws added to the National Defense Appropriation Acts of recent years have gutted the Bill of Rights. It is now lawful to arrest, torture, and hold American citizens without trial and without a legal defense. The people who own the government can legally kill you. We are headed into the worst financial crisis in modern history. It will be far worse than 1933. Only 3 million Americans starved to death in the 1930s. This will be worse than that. The bankers have to make even more drastic plans so you will not be able to say no. In the past, a financial crisis meant war. This time, I do not believe the American military will allow World War III. The U.S. and Russian militaries set up direct links in 2011 to avoid a war. Besides, the U.S. cannot fight a war and win. Remember that list of seven nations General Clark said the Pentagon was told to invade? The U.S. has some troops in Syria, but could never invade Lebanon and take on Hezbollah. And forget a direct assault on Iran. That is beyond our ability. We could start a thermonuclear war against Tehran and Beirut, but such a war would spread. When I was in high school, I knew we would never have a nuclear war. Why? Because eight bombs kill rich people, and that is very bad. But starvation rids us of the poor, and that is a very good weapon from the banker's point of view. The bankers are planning a different kind of war. I think the Trump administration, by its appointments, has prepared the way for a civil war. Trump has three generals in key positions, including Homeland Security. He has a man at the CIA who graduated first in his class from West Point and served for 5 years as a tank commander. But Trump has others in his admin who will limit his civil war responses. This is from Bloomberg. Quote, former Goldman Sachs partner Steve Mnuchin served as Trump's national finance chairman and is now Trump's nominee for U.S. Treasury Secretary. Trump has also tapped Goldman Sachs president and the bank's de facto number two, Gary Cohn, to be his top economic advisor in the White House. Other Goldman alums in Trump's inner circle include Anthony Scaramucci, a former Goldman banker and a member of the Trump transition team's executive committee, as well as Steve Bannon, Trump's campaign manager. After 8 years as the face of Wall Street greed and the target of public scorn, bankers at Goldman Sachs can be cheerful again. Max Keiser and Stacy Hubert reported that Goldman has moved his hedge operations from London to New York because they now feel free to commit unlimited fraud in the U.S. Trump is weighed down by other entrenched interests, So there is little he can do without being assassinated. But he is currently fighting back against the media, and his Attorney General Sessions will lead the resistance by investigation human trafficking, which will include pedophilia. That and the investigations into the Clinton Foundation will take down the establishment and provide Trump with more room to maneuver. But all that goodwill Trump has been gaining since Election Day will go out the window when the dollar dies. The bankers deliberately put America into a trap with no exit. They use trade deals like NAFTA to send millions of jobs overseas. The Warren economists determined that Americans were paid higher wages than Europeans because we had abundant natural resources like coal, oil, iron, and timber. We extracted those resources and added value with highly skilled labor. Thus, we earned a third more than Europeans doing the same work. But those same Warrations told us that we would have to cut wages as soon as we raised our population above 150 million and had to import natural resources. Does anyone remember what the price of a barrel of oil was in 1970 when we had 130 million fewer people? The bankers decided to print dollars to prop up the standard of living they had been attacking. They added government workers through deficit financing. Today, we have 30.6 million federal, state, and local government workers, if you count contractors, and we print dollars to buy cars, electronics, clothes, oil, and everything else by giving people overseas even more IU nothing reserve, Federal Reserve notes. We also temporarily pay the wages and retirement benefits of government workers with that same soon-to-be worthless green paper. James Rickards has been advising the CIA and the Pentagon since 2000. He has said, "We are in a currency war. When the dollar dies, we can buy imports with gold or with our food." He said the price of imported goods will rise 500% on the day after the dollar is no longer an international reserve currency. The corollary is that foreigners will see American food as a bargain and will clear out the shelves in our grocery stores. That is when the nationwide food riots begin. Now, we can see the real possibility of a civil war and even race riots as whites, blacks, and Hispanics battle for food. I use the term limited hangout civil war. Perhaps I should explain. Majority of people believe the government lied to us about both the JFK assassination and 9/11. Limited hangout position on 9/11 is that Bush, or rather Cheney and Rumsfeld, let it happen. They knew it was coming, but did nothing to stop it. Norm Mineta told us Rumsfeld was told every few minutes that a plane was approaching the Pentagon, but he did not let an interceptor take it down. The truth of this is the North and South Towers had 47 central core steel columns and 236 perimeter columns for a total of 283. For the buildings to fall straight down at nearly free fall speed, all 283 connections from the columns to each of the 110 floors had to be cut within a second of each other. Keeping in mind open air fires cannot reach half of the temperature required to melt steel, how do you explain 2x110x283, 62,260 connections in the two towers all being severed simultaneously by an office fire? Isn't this a definition of a controlled demolition? So towers 1, 2, and 7 were taken down by controlled demolitions. To do that, you need keys to the buildings and the permission of management. The two Jewish men who held the lease did not go to work on 9/11. Larry Silverstein's two adult children did not go to work. What are the odds? Odigo Instant Messaging Service went out an alert in Hebrew telling Israelis to stay away from the World Trade Center on 9/11. No such message was sent out in English for other Jewish Americans or Gentiles who worked in the towers. A limited hangout civil war is something of a misnomer. When a civil war or a race war starts, it will not be limited. What a limited hangout civil war means is that the bankers and the media they own will try to keep control of the narrative. Their problem is that all they can offer is a narrative. Bankers cannot offer a solution to the coming financial collapse because they would lose the source of their wealth, which is to legally rob us of ours. A depression is a period in time when unpaid debts are canceled en masse. There are three ways to cancel unpayable debts. The first is hyperinflation. The Weimar Republic tried that in 1923. If you raise prices 100,000%, you do make your debts appear to be smaller. That did not work out well. Or you can make your debts disappear, either in bankruptcy court or in farm and home mortgage foreclosures. America tried that in 1933 with bad results. The money supply contracted by a third, which only made things worse. We will have martial law. But, as I said, that will fail without a workable and painless cure to the depression. The ancient kings of Babylon and Sumer used debt cancellation to end a depression. The Bible writers called it the Jubilee. Debt cancellation is the third solution to a depression. It is the only peaceful and painless way out of our dire circumstances. The military could use martial law to arrest the bankers and to seize their assets to fund debt cancellation. We should issue a non-interest-bearing currency like Lincoln's greenbacks or the Bradbury period. We also should repeal fractional reserve banking. Or the military can let rioters kill millions who survived the Great Starvation. And then let the bankers release a series of plagues. They would need to make sure everyone over 50 who would want to collect a pension died because the bankers stole everything. The bankers need to reduce world population below a billion, which was the foundation studies they paid for, said was desirable. Debt cancellation is my favorite solution for a depression. You can read about it here. And then he gives several videos he's been putting up that explain it. Not a very cheerful picture, people, but then we are not people who, like Ola Damagar calls, happy to have their eyes shut. So thank you very much. So now the tribune has up World Trade Center's infamous 91st Street floor, Israelis art student project. Thank you. We've been talking about her. Here we go. That is, this, first of all, is by Russ Winner of the New Nationalist. It was put up on March 2. In the period leading up to 9/11, a group of Israelis, non-U.S. citizens, managed to secure temporary construction passes to perform work on the 91st floor of Larry Poet Silverstein's leased one WTC-1. These passes gave them access to the entire WTC complex. Pretense was an art project called The Bee Thing, and the group is called Gelatin. After securing their passes, Gelatin proceeded to remove the heavy WTC windows of an office space on the 91st floor and reportedly constructed a prefab balcony outside of the building. Then they stretched putty around the windows and filmed it by helicopter as a stunt. The New York Times even felt strangely compelled to cover this story and considered it newsworthy or a backstory. On the right is the photo of the balcony as shown in the newspaper article, and you can see that for yourself. This may sound innocent enough for the dum-dums, except for the fact that photos taken from the artist's book called The Bee Thing and used in the Times article from inside the 91st floor camp out revealed boxes stacked to the ceiling with the letters and numbering BB18 on the side. BB18 is a model number for a fuse holder accessory, as described. Features, benefits of this product. And I won't click onto that, read the whole thing. You can if you wish. Going on, quote, purpose is to save space and workload in a complicated wiring situation. Decreases wiring terminations. Small footprint reduces space requirements. Reduces assembly time. Prevents accidental finger exposure. Quick and safe method of changing fuse holder configurations allows for future expansion, improves troubleshooting, eliminates power distribution block, end quote. Also, take note that the ceiling tiles have been totally removed and exposed in steel girders. Following little Jim and perhaps a calling card was included in the op's egotistical, self-absorbed, and freakish book. It reads, the operation room is hidden, and the balcony is part of the plan. And then it draws that picture. The impact points of the planes were at the 93rd to the 98th floors. Below, cartoon physics of an aircraft imprint created by its flimsy aluminum wings that could not penetrate steel exterior columns. Wile E. Coyote cartoon physics. You are being insulted by criminals. It shows the picture. Going on. Buried and apparently long forgotten is this 2002 Daily Mail story about the U.S. arresting and deporting 200 Israelis, some of whom posed as art students, for spying and espionage activities in the lead up to 9/11. In addition, here is the DEA's report on Israeli activities in the U.S. just prior to 9/11. So much for the nonsensical theory that Muslims in Afghan caves pulled off this crime of the century. A new book, at least it was when he wrote this, right? Methodical Illusion explores the details. Additionally, we have yet another coincidence. The building was powered down over a weekend prior to 9/11. And you can click on the Methodical Illusion and the CNN, of course, being International Women's Day, of course, I think Rebecca Roth, so many people that like to read, like the love story type and, you know, simple novels with a nice mystery angle to them, who have read, and she's never relented in proving that Israel was guilty. And then besides that, for anybody who doesn't want to read the novels, the fixes beneath them, there is the wonderful megabytes of research that she has got over her hard work all these years through Freedom of Information Act that she's more than willing to let anyone have for cost only, and even willing to work with researchers to go over it, since she has so much support in the transportation business and they can read it. And if you just send her money for the cost of mailing, she says she will send it to you. All right, thank you. Next up, I am going to continue with this theme of war. Today went up another one. I might jump to it. Though I have written down, U.S. admits buying radioactive weapons in Syria because I am still so upset by what we've done to the Middle East. Oh my God, I'm upset. I can't get over it. So I'm going to go ahead and read it. That was my plan because that's why we're getting off doing this, getting away doing this, all because of 911 and Israel running everything and all the goyim, as they call us, slaves. And don't get me started. U.S. admits using it that left thousands of Iraqi babies deformed by mad agorists of the Free Thought Project. One of the least talked about war crimes committed by the United States is the use of depleted uranium, a highly controversial radioactive waste that's been dumped into Iraq by the ton. In spite of multiple international watchdog groups and health organizations pointing out the dangers of using DU, and in spite of the Pentagon claiming they wouldn't use it, the United States just admitted to using it in Syria. For those that aren't familiar with the radioactive waste that is DU, it is the byproduct of the production of enriched uranium for use as fuel in nuclear reactors and in the manufacture of nuclear weapons. It is also the U.S. military's preferred material to use for armor plating and armor-piercing projectiles. In the first 3 weeks of the conflict in Iraq in 2003, the U.S. military dumped more than 2,000 tons of this chemically toxic and radioactive waste onto the Iraqi people. Because the half-life of DU is millions of years, the massive quantities dropped in Iraq over the course of the invasion continue to pose a serious health risk to those exposed to it. Amounts in bullets, shells, and bombs vary from 300 grams to 7 tons in the Bunker Buster missiles, which rained down from the skies over Iraq for years. In the course of the two U.S.-led wars in Iraq, it is estimated that tens of thousands of tons of DU have dropped from the sky onto the people. The admitted use of DU is solely reserved to the United States and the United Kingdom. Since its adverse effects first began appearing, there has been a massive effort to conceal the true and horrifying impact it's had. However, on Monday, a spokesman for the U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, told Foreign Policy that 5,265 armor-piercing DU rounds were used in November 2015 during two air raids against Islamic State. IS, formerly ISIL, oil tanker convoys in the Deir ez-Zor and Hasakah provinces in eastern Syria. A 10-ground attack aircraft fired the projectiles from the 30-millimeter rotating cannons, destroying about 350 tanker trucks, according to CENTCOM spokesman Major Josh Yox. A quote from him, Stars and Stripes at Facebook. Officials confirm the U.S. used depleted uranium weapons on the battlefield in Iraq and Syria. And it shows a picture of the United States used doing that. Officials have confirmed that the U.S. military is, etc. Going on, this admission by the U.S. that it used DU comes in contrast to a March 2015 statement from the coalition spokesman, who had explicitly ruled out its use in Syria, saying U.S. and coalition aircraft have not been and will not be using depleted uranium munitions in Iraq or Syria during Operation Inherent Resolve. While the U.S. loves to tout the exceptional toughness of DU, they continue to ignore and, in fact, have covered up and denied the contamination of ground and water and the significant risk of toxicity, birth defects, and cancer when inhaled or ingested by humans or animals at Facebook, ICBUW. These DU, it might be at Twitter, by the way, these DU contaminated locations in hashtag Syria pose a risk to civilian health and must be isolated and addressed as soon as conditions allow. Yes, Twitter, airways, status. Not only does DU pose a significant risk to those who live in the areas where the U.S. has dumped it, but it is also linked to tens of thousands of potential cancer cases among American troops. However, those numbers are only estimated because immediately after the U.S. began dumping tons of it in Iraq, the Veterans Administration began blocking medical journals from accessing cancer stats in its registry. In spite of horrific cases of cancer among us troops who were proven to test positive for DU in their urine after coming back stateside, the DOD continues to claim it is safe. The World Health Organization, who even got on board with the cover-up in 2013, quote, "The rates for spontaneous abortion, stillbirths, and congenital birth defects found in the study are consistent with, or even lower than international estimates. This study provides no clear evidence to suggest an unusually high rate of congenital birth defects in Iraq," wrote the WHO in their summary findings of birth defects related to DU in Iraq. However, this was in stark contrast to the findings from Iraqi Ministry of Health officials who were involved in the same study. Doctors at the Basra Maternity Hospital in southern Iraq have told the BBC that they have seen a 60% rise in birth defects since 2003, according to the BBC. The MOH officials confirmed that the joint report would furnish damning evidence that rates of birth defects are higher in areas experiencing heavy fighting in the 2003 war. In an early press release, WHO similarly acknowledged existing MOH statistics showing high number of CBD cases in the high-risk areas selected for study as reported by The Guardian. However, none of that happened. In spite of this cover-up in the West, Iraqi doctors and multiple peer-reviewed studies have documented a dramatic increase in infant mortality, cancer, and leukemia in the aftermath of U.S. military bombardment. In Fallujah, doctors are witnessing a massive, unprecedented number of heart defects and an increase in the number of nervous system defects, according to The Guardian. Analysis. Of pre-2003 data compared to now show that the rate of congenital heart defects was 95 per 1,000 births, 13 times the rate found in Europe. Official Iraqi government statistics show that prior to the outbreak of the first Gulf War in 1991, the rate of cancer cases in Iraq was 40 out of 100,000 people. By 1995, it had increased to 800 out of 100,000 people, By 2005, it had doubled to at least 1,600 out of 100,000 people. Current estimates show the increasing trend continuing. In a 2010 International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health article, Busby and two colleagues, Malik Hamdan and Ansar Ariabi, reported a 38-fold increase in leukemia, a 10-fold increase in breast cancer, and infant mortality rates 8 times higher than in neighboring Kuwait. These numbers are also likely far greater than reported as women in Iraq who give birth to babies with deformities feel stigmatized and often don't report them, according to Mashkan Sabalizabani, a Michigan-based environmental toxicologist who won the 2015 Rachel Carson Award. It is also estimated that the rate of congenital malformations among newborn babies is 14 times higher than that of Japan immediately following the detonation of two atomic bombs. And now, the people of Syria will begin their horrifying journey down the deadly path to the same fate as Iraq. As the disturbing images in the video below from Democracy Now! Illustrate, war is hell. And you can see that video there. Thank you. I think I'll just jump now to five signs we're headed toward a major war by Darius Shatemezebi of the Anti-Media put up on the first day of March. In January of this year, former Soviet Union leader Mikhail Gorbachev warned that the whole world is preparing for war. There are many indicators that back up Gorbachev's assertion, but to discuss them in their entirety would take a dissertation or two. Instead, we have put together a list of the five most obvious signs of impending war currently being overlooked by the media. As a result of these oversights, the public is also missing them. Number one, travel ban. The Trump administration's travel ban, which targeted seven majority Muslim nations, makes little sense in the context of fighting international terrorism. A Department of Homeland Security report already found no evidence of any extra threat posed by the nations on the travel ban. Conversely, a Saudi official has admitted Saudi Arabia's long-standing practice of supporting terrorism as a political tool. Yet, Saudi Arabia managed to escape the list. So did Turkey, a country that has extensively aided ISIS fighters. Qatar, which has spent immense amounts of money arming fanatical jihadists. The United Arab Emirates, where the majority of the funding for the 911 attacks passed through, and the list goes on. Instead, the travel ban was purely political. With help from the anti-Trump media establishment, the ban worked wonders, separating the American public between those who oppose Trump's every move and those who support him wholeheartedly in his quest to make America great again. But little attention was paid to the reality of the ban. Six of the seven countries on Trump's travel ban were featured in a memo that was adopted shortly after 9/11 that detailed how the U.S. was going to topple the governments of seven countries as exposed by four-star General Weston Clark. The countries featured on Clark's list were Iraq, Libya, Lebanon, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Iran. Any accusations that Clark's list is a conspiracy theory are completely debunked by the events of the last 2 decades. Iraq was invaded in 2003, and the U.S. has been backing warlords in Somalia and bombing the country for some time now. The Pentagon is reportedly considering expanding U.S. involvement in the African nation. Israel, was eager to take out Lebanon in 2006, but failed to do so. Though Israel warned just last year that the next encounter with Lebanon will be ferocious and terrible. U.S. troops are on the ground in Sudan. Libya was destroyed in 2011, which paved the way for the transfer of weapons and fighters into Syria, a country bound to Iran by a mutual defense agreement. In the context of Trump's travel ban, Lebanon is replaced by Yemen, the latest addition to the playbook amid fears that an insurgency within Yemen could place an Iranian-aligned government on Saudi Arabia's border. Including Iran in the travel ban, despite the fact Iran is not currently embroiled in a major civil conflict of its own, is not currently bombing any other countries, and is one of the major partners in the fight against ISIS, demonstrates something more sinister at play than mere concerns regarding international terrorism. Number two, Trump's anti-Iran rhetoric. The Obama administration, having successfully taken out Libya in 2011, was tasked with finishing the job in Syria and toppling the Assad regime. Overwhelming support for Syrian rebels battling the Syrian government was replaced by urgent calls to intervene directly in 2013. But Obama failed to gain international and public support for airstrikes on the Syrian government. Russia diplomatically put its hand up to offer a different proposal altogether, also warning that they have their plans should the American military decide to strike Syria as Obama intended. Any speculation that the real focus of the Syrian war was aimed at Iran was proven to be not just mere conjecture. Obama immediately thereafter warned Iran that just because the U.S. did not attack Syria did not mean the U.S. would and still strike Iran over its alleged nuclear program. The Russian military intervened overtly in Syria in 2015. Which only further foiled Washington's plans for regime change in the country, as admitted by former Secretary of State John Kerry in a leaked audio recording. As such, the Trump administration has appeared to move the focus away from Syria.
South Africa in Western schools, other than that there was an evil apartheid government of white racists who oppressed everyone until the great Saint Nelson Mandela came along. Now you can learn the real history of exploration, conflict, concentration camps for the Boers, Jewish-funded black terrorism, Winnie Mandela and her necklacing, rampant murder and rape under the ANC, the so-called squatter camps, how the Rainbow Nation is a blueprint for what's to come for whites worldwide, and so much more. Between Heaven and Hell, The True Story of Whites in South Africa by Sinead McCarthy. Free to watch at whitesouthafrica.com. Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Thank you. And continuing on about the Trump administration, looks like it's moving away from Syria, but really, in the George W. Bush's approach when he was in office, going back to Iran. But we all know Northern Truth Seeker has posted today that our U.S. troops are in northern Syria. But reading on with this article, Trump has assembled a team that is obsessed with Iran and has accused Iran of being the biggest state sponsor of terrorism. Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, also stated that pushing back on Iran's aggressive efforts to increase its arc of influence from Tehran through to the Mediterranean was a priority. Trump was likely thrilled by these statements, as May successfully secured 100% support for NATO from Trump the next day. Following an Iranian missile launch, the Trump administration officially put Iran on notice. The U.S. government wanted to make sure the Iranians understood we are not going to sit by and not act on their actions. Just this past month, Trump warned in a tweet that Iran was playing with fire. And he vowed he would not be anywhere near as kind as his predecessor was to Iran. This is important because Trump has accused Iran of breaching its obligations under the nuclear agreement, though that nuclear agreement does not prohibit non-nuclear tests. The nuclear deal reached in 2015 was viewed as one of Obama's greatest diplomatic achievements, but in reality, it was doomed to fail right from the start. In the same way, Libya was coaxed out of rapidly advancing its weapons programs before being bombed back into the Middle Ages in 2011. It may be the case that this diplomatic approach to Iran was always a smokescreen to give the United States more reason leverage when attempting to convince the international arena that a strike on Iran was justified. As outlined in the book, Which Path to Persia? Options for a New American Strategy Toward Iran, quotes, for those who favor regime change or a military attack on Iran, either by the United States or Israel, there is a strong agreement, argument to be made for trying this option first. Inciting regime change in Iran would be greatly assisted by convincing the Iranian people that their government is so ideologically blinkered that it refuses to do what is best for the people, and instead clings to a policy that could only bring ruin on the country. The ideal scenario in this case would be that the United States and the international community present a package of positive inducements so enticing that the Iranian citizenry would support the deal, only to have the regime reject it. In a similar vein, any military operation against Iran would likely be very unpopular around the world and require the proper international context, both to ensure the logistical support the operation would require and to minimize the blowback from it. The best way to minimize international opprobrium and maximize support, however grudging or covert, is to strike only when there is a widespread conviction that the Iranians were given but then rejected a superb offer, one so good that only a regime determined to acquire nuclear weapons and acquire them for the wrong reasons would turn it down. By claiming that through its missile test, Iran is violating a deal that Trump never supported to begin with, he can lay the groundwork for an all-out confrontation with Iran that could garner support from the international community as well as the misinformed American public. Number three, Iran dumps dollar. Currency is a major driving factor behind the walls of our generation. Iraq reportedly gave up the U.S. dollar in 2000 for the euro and netted a handsome profit for doing so. The U.S. military invaded in 2003 and immediately switched oil sales in Iraq from the euro back to the dollar. Iraq was also under heavy U.S. sanctions that spanned the course of at least a decade prior to the invasion. Comparatively, in response to Trump's anti-Iran rhetoric and the travel ban, Iran officially dumped the U.S. dollar. Iran has also been on the receiving end of sanctions since the Bush administration, and Trump has slapped fresh sanctions on Iran over the missile test. In the lead-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, our television sets were rife with an unprecedented amount of disinformation regarding Iraq's nuclear program and the threat it posed to the world. Conversely, Israel has been crying wolf over Iran's nuclear program for at least two decades. Yet no actual evidence of Iranian nuclear weapons program has been produced. The Trump administration also accused Iran of attacking a U.S. naval vessel, an attack that never took place. Make no mistake, the Trump administration is laying the groundwork for a war with Iran by sowing the anti-Iranian seeds necessary to take the American public into another dangerous war in the Middle East. Number four, Syria. While Trump appeared at first to have heralded a new approach to the Syrian conflict, namely, that Assad should be left alone and the real focus of American foreign policy should be on defeating ISIS, the Trump administration is stepping up its Syria operation behind the curtains. Trump is reportedly planning to send troops to Syria, and he is not the only external power doing so. Iran's regional arch-rival, Saudi Arabia, which has incessantly accused Tehran of backing rebels in neighboring Yemen without producing any real evidence, is also reportedly sending troops into Syria, and it has. Iranian-backed regime troops will not look favorably on any foreign invading force, particularly Saudi troops. Saudi Arabia has already made it clear that it intends to liberate areas of Syria from ISIS and will be on the ground to ensure that liberated areas do not fall under the control of Hezbollah, Iran, or the regime. How far will they go to ensure this? Not to mention, how can one country go into another and say that they want to ensure that the land does not fall back into the hands of the people governing that country? Five. Military drills and military alliances. The United States and the United Kingdom have already begun military drills that simulate a potential conflict with Iran. As reported by Russian state-owned news site RT, Iran has staged a massive military drill of its own, spanning 2 million square kilometers. This preparation for war can be seen across the globe. Russia is also holding military drills as NATO troops and tanks encroach upon its border. Iran is seeking even closer military relations with Russia and North Korea. The Baltic states that border Russia are running drills too, supposedly out of fear that the Kremlin will invade. Russia's long-standing ally, China, is also currently running drills for its own geostrategic purposes. Germany is reportedly seeking to increase its troop numbers to 200,000 troops, even though such a move may put its neighbors on edge. Philippines, having decided to give the political middle finger to the United States and instead forge closer relations with Russia and China, welcomed Russian warships to its shores in January of this year. Looking at these military drills and alliances in the context of the above developments paints a very grim picture for where humanity is headed. Thank you. And now, today's news, Marching Toward World War III by Aloysius Jackson. On the Tribune, the election of Donald Trump, for those who can read between the lines, is a clear indication of what is to come. While millions of patriotic Americans are cheering an expected return to personal freedom and the U.S. Constitution, those who are awake aren't quite so optimistic. Never mind that Trump has already backed out of campaign promises and appointed Goldman Sachs executives to his cabinet. When we step back to look at the big picture, several things become obvious. First of all, there was no way an outsider that opposed the American status quo would have been elected simply by the will of the people. Such an individual would have never been given airtime. Just look at the treatment Ron Paul received. Secondly, there are multiple warring factions within the power structure that rules this planet. The election of Donald Trump, as others have pointed out, was the victory of Zionist Jews over globalist Jews. Nothing more. One faction wants the planet to be ruled by a global cabal. The other wants an Israel-US-dominated ruling faction. And while the latter is preferable for Americans now, it is not sustainable. If we read the Albert Pike letter's description regarding the events of World War III, we see that political Zionism, Israel, is destroyed. That fact makes being their closest ally dangerous at best. In the letter, we see that World War III is geared toward destabilizing and demoralizing the nations of the world to the point where they will receive the true light of Lucifer. It is not about large-scale nuclear war. Enter Donald Trump. His job is to get America back on its feet in terms of military and economic strength, as well as in morale and patriotism. They need us strong for the upcoming war. Many have begun to compare Trump to Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. Besides the obvious physical similarities, consider the following. Mussolini opposed democracy, liberty, and socialism. He believed in fascism, which he defined as the merger between corporate and government power. Trump pretty much defines such a concept. His financial empire was built on government kickbacks. Then there is the famous story of Mussolini that, as he was being killed, he stated, quotes, "If you kill me now, I will come back at the head of a far more powerful nation in need of a leader, and you will feel the arm." End of quote. Reincarnation? Anyone? I have a theory Since the global elites love so much to repeat patterns over and over again, maybe World War III won't be so much different than World War II. Adolf Hitler took a destitute nation and transformed it into the pinnacle of European culture and power within 5 years. He was then attacked by more than 30 other countries, and Germany was completely destroyed. In the end, more than 20 million Germans lost their lives. Germany is an occupied country to this day. I believe that Trump / Mussolini is our Hitler and we are Nazi Germany. I believe Trump will fix many of America's problems and then lead us into a war which we will lose. The mainstream media is playing its part. Their propaganda mouthpieces demonize Russia, Iran, and Syria. Muslim terrorism is painted as our greatest enemy, while the Jews are praised. Meanwhile, our military is spread thinly around the world. Although we spend more on our military than the next 7 countries combined, our technology is lagging behind that of Russia and in some areas, even China. That being said, America's military is still large and formidable. These developments are about evening the playing field to create a war which will drag out, just like the last two. The purpose of this article is just to get people to think about the nature and purpose of the upcoming war in hopes that we can avoid it. The only way to avoid it, I believe, is for the majority of Americans to refuse to support it. World War I raged for several years before America joined, which only happened after enough public support had been generated. Again, the purpose of World War III will be to demoralize the people of the world into accepting the true light of Lucifer. Whatever that means, it will probably seem like a great step forward. However, it will only mean that the human cattle get a bigger pen to play in. Not the same thing as true freedom. As stated by Giffey, none are so hopelessly enslaved as those who falsely believe they are free. True freedom can never be given to us or come from the outside. It must come from inside us, when collectively we are not afraid to speak and act as we feel, proving we are not directly harming anyone else. So thank you. I'm going to now move on. U.S. said to expand South China Sea conflict. This was written a month ago, but it's still interesting. Joseph Thomas. Triumphalism followed the election of U.S. President Donald Trump, particularly among those opposed to U.S. foreign policy under U.S. President Barack Obama. In particular, hope was rekindled that America will withdraw from the many provocative conflicts it was cultivating, ranging from the Middle East to East Asia. However, triumphalism and hope are now dashed as the new U.S. administration moves clearly and in earnest to not only continue on with these confrontations, but expand them. For students of history, particularly those following events in Asia Pacific, the prospect of the U.S. moving its confrontation with China forward for control over the region is hardly a surprise. A quick history lesson of U.S. imperialism in Asia. The United States had occupied the Philippines, declaring it a U.S. territory from 1898 to 1946. It had also been involved in the military occupation and several armed clashes in China with Chinese forces, including during the Second Opium War and the Boxer Rebellion. Such conflicts saw Chinese fighters attempt to remove by force foreign influence, including supposedly Christian missionaries used to impose U.S. and European sociopolitical control over China. During this period of overt American colonialization throughout Asia Pacific, the annexation of Taiwan was also considered as an American analog of Britain's annexation of Hong Kong. In Thomas Cox's 1973 book, Harbingers of Change, American Merchants and the Formosa Taiwan Annexation Scheme, published by the University of California Press, Cox wrote, "Since it appeared unlikely that Taiwan would long remain a part of the Chinese Empire, and there was ample justification for action by the United States, U.S. Commissioner in China, Peter Parker, argued that the United States should move quickly. I believe Formosa and the world will be better for the former coming under a civilized power," he wrote. It should be noted that Parker's advocacy of the U.S. annexation of Taiwan was backed not by political ideology, though it was certainly presented as such publicly, but by U.S. business interests at the time, particularly those of the Nye brothers, merchants involved heavily in U.S.-Chinese trade, including the movement of opium across the region. Regional dynamics would change just before, during, and immediately after World War II, with the resurgence of localized power and independence movements ousting Western colonial powers. This included the ousting of British and French holdings across the region, such as Myanmar, Malaysia, Indonesia, and across Indochina, which included Laos, Cambodia, and, of course, Vietnam. The ousting by force of French administrators from Vietnam brought the United States back into the region more directly at an unprecedented scale. And while the United States would claim its reasons for intervening in Southeast Asia were predicated on preventing a domino effect of spreading communism, leaked documents known as the Pentagon Papers made it abundantly clear that America was simply continuing its hegemonic pursuits vis-a-vis China in an effort to encircle, contain, and eventually subdue a rising Beijing. The U.S. State Department's own Office of the Historian, in a section titled 189 Draft Memorandum from Secretary of Defense McNamara to President Johnson, dated 1965, states explicitly, "The February decision to bomb North Vietnam and the July approval of Phase 1 deployments to make sense only if they are in support of a long-run United States policy to contain communist China." The papers openly advocate U.S. global hegemony, stating, "The role we have inherited and have chosen for ourselves and for the future is to extend our influence and power to thwart ideologies that are hostile to these aims and to move the world as best we can in the direction we prefer. Our ends cannot be achieved and our leadership role cannot be played if some powerful and virulent nation, whether Germany, Japan, Russia, or China, is allowed to organize their part of the world according to a philosophy contrary to ours." And again, just like during deliberations over the possible annexation of Taiwan during the 19th century, U.S. ambitions in Asia-Pacific may be rhetorically presented as pursuit of a particular ideology, but are, in reality, underpinned by economic interests, which seek to move into and subsequently dominate markets globally, displacing anything and everything pre-existing through coercive diplomacy, or through indirect or direct military force. 21st century American hegemony. Fast forward to the 21st century. During the administration of former U.S. President Barack Obama, the U.S. pivoted toward Asia in an attempt to reassert itself in the region, quickly escaping out from under what remained of over a century of U.S.-American hegemony. The pivot failed, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, being categorically resisted and rejected across Asia, and feigned U.S. reapproachment with several of China's neighbors turning into confrontations across Southeast Asia, as Washington attempted to replace governments friendly with Beijing with those that would toe an anti-Beijing line. In an attempt to conceal what is a decades-long agenda, and the continuation of Obama's pivot, U.S. President Donald Trump's counselor, Stephen Bannon, as revealed by a Guardian title, Steve Bannon, we're going to war in the South China Sea, no doubt, would claim that China, along with Islam, presented a menace to the Judeo-Christian West. This ideological rhetoric is aimed at distracting the public, convincing them that U.S. policy toward China is now determined by Trump's ideological xenophobic tendencies, rather than merely the latest logical iteration of Obama's pivot and the Vietnam era's full-scale military containment strategy. Also noteworthy in Bannon's incomplete thought is his omission of so-called Christian missionaries in China and the role they played in the attempted invasion, occupation, and subjugation of China during the 19th century by U.S. European interest. The Guardian would report, Bannon's sentiments and his position in Trump's inner circle add to fears of a military confrontation with China after Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that the U.S. would deny China access to the 7 artificial islands. Expert warned any blockade would lead to war. Bannon is clearly wary of China's growing clout in Asia and beyond, framing the relationship as entirely adversarial, predicting a global culture clash in the coming years. Quote, you have an expansionist Islam, and you have an expansionist China, right? They are motivated. They're arrogant. They're on the march, and they think the Judeo-Christian West is on the retreat, Bannon said during a February 2016 radio show. And while The Guardian attempts to pose as sounding the alarm over the Trump administration's seemingly xenophobic and confrontational stance, its own omission of America's longstanding attempts to encircle, contain, and subjugate China, regardless of who occupies the White House or what rhetoric accompanies such reiteration of U.S. policy toward China, serves as complicity. For policymakers across Asia, understanding history and the special interests that have and still do drive American foreign policy is key to seeing through inflammatory rhetoric and essential in analyzing and preparing solutions for continued attempts by Washington to reassert itself in a region an ocean away from its own shores in a modern day continuation of Western colonialism. The nations of Asia Pacific have fought hard to escape and rise above over the past generations. So thank you. The next one I pulled out, as if you haven't guessed yet, the Tribune does have a whole article about war together, is Lobbying and the Arms Trade, put up on January 29th. Written by Mike Walsh. With its staggering $692 billion war, in quotes, defense budget, the U.S. arms industry constitutes 43% of the world's military expenditure. This amount is not far behind Britain and Russia's combined export trade. And there is a chart that shows that. The financial resources and political clout exercised by this military machine's lobbying apparatus dwarf many national interests and economies. Arms manufacturing and pharmaceutical conglomerates are far more omnipotent and influential than our many governments. Lobbying is a euphemism for sharp-suited salesmen drawing on blank checkbooks to sell their company's products. Arms industry's lobbyists exert enormous influence on governmental policy. It is in their interest to continually exaggerate or fake threats of war, just as rogue windows salesman over stress fault in their perfect windows. Mainstream media news desk receive a constant stream of cry wolf misinformation spewed out by the press departments of the arms conglomerates. Barry White, a British journalist, participated in a Brussels tour that covered the European arms industry lobby. In that one city, more than 20,000 lobbyists influenced the European Union's institutions. Most sales representatives operate from offices situated in the 4 square kilometers surrounding the European Union's Commission and Parliament. An impressive 70% of these pushy salesmen and women are employed by the corporate giants. Many are engaged by non-governmental organizations or self-interest organizations such as trade unions. Former EU Commissioner Marion Fichy-Boyle described Brussels as a lobbying paradise equal to the power of U.S. lobbyists. And by the way, there's a picture there showing modern warfare. A $70 million aircraft drops a $350,000 bomb on a $10 tent. Reading on, the U.S. arms industry lobby is phenomenal in the influence it wields. One might wonder why this should be so, as the EU is mainly dependent upon the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, 70% financed and equipped by the United States. The heat is on because of the adoption of the Lisbon Treaty that replaced the now obsolete EU Constitution. Since there has been a European initiative to become less reliant on NATO that has hitherto fueled the European arms industry lobby. According to Barry White, the arms industry seized the moment. Following the dissolution of its constitution, the EU became an independent military alliance with an infrastructure for civil military interventions. The EU has its own armaments agency. Governments, through banking and arms industry lobbyists, are under continual pressure to prepare or engage in conflict. This explains why the electorate are confused as to why parliamentarians wage wars they oppose. The voters are up against dominant, well-financed lobbying forces actively influencing government decisions. The electorate exercise their powers of persuasion one day every 5 years. The lobbyists do it every single day. And there's a quote from Lucius Anaeus Seneca: "Be wary of the man who urges an action in which he himself incurs no risk." Reading on, it is doubtful if lobbyists take Christmas off. One can presume that key decision makers in government receive many Christmas inducements from arms industry lobbyists. It is unlikely that the Christmas cards sent by such salesmen bear the message, "Peace on earth to all men." The European arms industry use a myriad of strategies to penetrate decision-making institutions. Using a system known in political circles as entryism, lobbyists sit on advisory groups and become members of think tanks. Arms industry salesmen are slipped on to various advisory and expert groups from which they influence budget decisions and political strategy. The arms industry salesmen are paid to cozy up to a government's key decision makers. An important part of their spiel is to invent internal and external threats, for without such, there would be no need for defense. And then there's a picture of that guy in Congress from, oh yeah, Senator Mitch McConnell, Kentucky, I hate to say it. "Here's a brilliant idea. Politicians should wear the logos of all the companies that back them. And he has all the logos of Citi, Shell, AIG, on and on. It looks so ridiculous, but that's what they should do. All of them sitting there in the House of Chambers for Congress, they all need to wear their money, people get money from, as logos. Politicians are not renowned for their principles. Parliamentarians are ambiguous about brown envelopes and other forms of corruption, often coming from modest backgrounds. Many members of Parliament, senators and congressmen on accessing the portals of power are overwhelmed by flattery, free lunches, riches, and a gravy train lifestyle undreamed of. Senators who voted to attack Syria received 83% more campaign money from military contractors than lawmakers voting no. The people's so-called representatives are a pushover for experienced, hard-headed, well-paid arms industry lobbyists. Lobbying is the ignition key of wars. On October 3, 1938, 4 days before the signing of the Munich Peace Agreement, the novelist and wife of British Member of Parliament, General Sir Edward Spears, bitterly complained, "Poor Edward, now there's bound to be a general election, and we are now faced with the prospect of losing £2,000 a year from the checks, 33,000 today's value. Can you believe it? And his seat in Parliament." End of her quote. In the check files, Boston University, Massachusetts, was found records of a telephone call from the pro-war, Prague-based Czech ambassador Jan Masaryk, made in September 1938. This recorded a conversation, quote, "Mr. Churchill is asking for more. Mr. Attlee is asking for more as well." These check files revealed that £2 million, £33 million at today's value, had already been sent from Prague to London in July 1938 for payments made to influential pro-war opposition conservative MPs. These included Winston Churchill, Anthony Eden, and Harold Macmillan, all of whom became prime ministers. The big four arms makers in Europe are BAE Systems, Finmeccanica, Eads, and Thales. As with the banking industry, there is little effective regulation of these corporate giants. Indeed, many are inextricably linked to government ministers, parliamentarians, infiltrated lobbyists, and government personnel in key decision-making positions. As a consequence, much arms material is bought without there being a need for it. In the meantime, service personnel on the front line are denied appropriate arms and equipment. If it were otherwise, then replacement solutions would not be needed. If that were to happen, then the only ones doing the dying would be those employed in the arms industry. And here's his poem, Rudyard Kipling, 1865 to 1936, poem, The Politician. I could not dig, I dared not rob, therefore I lied to please the mob. Now all my lies are proved untrue, and I must face the men I slew. What tale shall serve me here among mine angry and defrauded young? Now I'd like to turn to the propaganda art of Felix Albrecht. We're now going to Germany. That was also in it, and it's by Jay Ballinger, February 15, 2017. Felix Albrecht is another of these great German graphic artists from the war period, whose information on the internet is very sparse. Not to say very difficult to find, thanks to the work of websites such as Galeria d'Art, Through, we could get a sketchy glimpse of what the artist's career was like. Most of the information provided in this biography comes from this particular source. Felix Albrecht was a man who enjoyed a very successful professional life during the last years prior to the rise of the Third Reich in Germany, and, of course, during the years the political entity existed as well. Suffice to say that he received a lot of promotions during this period, especially during the 1930s. Though after World War II, judging by the information I have gathered, his career faded away completely. So much so that he never truly recovered. As it was the case with many other German artists who worked actively for the Reich, for his biography here, I had to semi-translate most of the information from the original source to make it a bit more intelligible. Bear in mind, there might be some inaccuracies. Biography. Felix Albrecht was born in Darmstadt in July 6, 1900. He was the son of a high school assistant. In 1906, he attended the Volksschule Mittweida in Saxony and then the grammar school in Chemnitz. He served at the military during the First World War as the volunteer runner in 1917 and 1918 and was discharged in Vienna in 1919 with the rank of sergeant. In 1921, he got his first job as a designer in the automobile factory, Mohl AG. Oberlichnati. He married sometime later in 1922. In March 5th of the same year, he founded the Atelier Albrecht, Albrecht Studio, with the piano maker Hans Seidel. Many of Felix Albrecht's illustrations are signed with the Atelier Albrecht moniker. The association lasted up to January 1, 1924. That was the year in which Albrecht became an engineer. By 1925, he joined the DNVP, German National People's Party, National Conservative Party. It was during that period, 1925-1927, when he studied at the Academy of Fine Arts in Berlin, finally becoming a graphic artist and an illustrator. In May 1927, he joined the NSDAP with card number 62499. Felix Albrecht became the author of many famous campaign posters for the party, commissioned by Dr. Goebbels himself. By the beginning of 1930, Albrecht is nominated, honored, voluntary Sturmführer of the SS. In June 12, 1931, he was promoted SS Sturmführer and collaborator of the Reichspropaganda of the NSDAP and RFSS as he continued with a very prolific production of posters, postcards, and book illustrations, including the ubiquitous Deutschland erwacht, Wer den Kampf und Sieg der NSDAP by Wilfried Bad and Heinrich Hoffmann. In 1933, Albrecht became official propagandist for the official bureau of the NSDAP. Shortly, by that time, he was promoted SS Oberstuhler. In the same year, he was appointed member of the House of Literature of the Reichsstiftungskammer for cinematography. Yes, I have had 6 weeks of intensive study in German, people. Going on. It was conversational German. Okay, in 1934, he became a consultant and contributor to the Hauptmann für Volksschulmacht of the NSDAP. So much was his production of propaganda items that in his studio at 36 Maybachführer in Berlin, he had at his disposal up to 12 graphic designers. September 9, 1934, Albrecht was promoted SS Hauptsturmführer. He married for the second time on June 7, 1935, to Erna Friedel, a Berliner who was 18 years younger than Albrecht. With Erna, he had a son, Karl, who was born on June 6, 1936. In that same year, the old Atelier Albrecht is incorporated into the leadership corps. On July 9, 1944, Albrecht was appointed SS Hauptsturmführer in the reserve. On November 9, 1944, Albrecht was promoted to SS Hauptstufuhrer of the Waffen-SS in Kreuzfeldtrinitätsdienst Lehrerstadt SS SSKRL of Vienna, Schönbrunn. In January 1945, he drew the two sketches for Die Welt stamps. In late March 1945, he left for Vienna with his family. In May 1945, Albrecht is captured by the Russians and held captive until 1949. Apparently, during his captivity, the Russian army used him as a painter to illustrate their own successes in the war's outcome. By August 1949, he finally managed to return to Berlin with his family. After the war, Albrecht tried to resume, with great difficulties, his career as graphic designer and illustrator. Gone were the days in which he had been one of the most promoted graphic artists in the Reich. So precarious was his financial situation that in 1958, the artist sold some of his private drawings to auction houses, claiming that they were original office work produced in Vienna in 1945 for the printing of stamps. But by 1964, an attorney general in Berlin accused Albrecht of fraud, stating that all those originals had been sold prior to the deal. As a result, Albrecht got a 500 marks fine for administrative offenses. The last book known featuring Phyllis Albrecht's art was Armel Streifen, Afrika Korps, Burckhardt, Hering, published in 1957. Felix Albrecht died on June 27, 1980 in Schönbrunn, Berlin. And then here, there's a whole long list of these various tags. Postcard style. It takes your mind back to the Third Reich. I'm just going to go down and look at them. Looks good to go to Germany for a minute. Think of what it could have been. And what it would have done for us. Okay, thank you. Now, as we all know, I'm sure who is listening here, Nick has had on more than once someone. I'll pull him up. He made a wonderful statement at Facebook, of all places, about something we haven't talked about yet on my show, and I don't think anywhere any other shows here. I try to listen to all of them, see. About the Academy Award that, sure enough, would you know, Steve gave the award to White Helmets, which is really Al-Qaeda. It's one nice thing. He did keep the director of White Helmets out, didn't he? So, wish I could play that war for you. By the way, the other author's name was Strong. Of those lyrics, and it was considered, by the way, very controversial for Motown to put out something so anti-war as it was. And many people are saying on the day that Starr died, they should have played that song, but they didn't. They didn't bring it back. Okay. Thank you for waiting. I'm glad I got through so many pieces about war, although we do hate it, don't we? But our friend, Vid Rebel, he still doesn't think the wars are going to happen. Okay, what I'm going to do is, next time I'm going to play it. And I'm going to pull up the Tribune, because there was a couple more that just came up this week that I very much wanted to read. Give me a second. Another one whose lyrics I'd like to read, and you can go to, is also about being against war, and it's by Guns N' Roses, originally from Beech Grove, Indiana. I didn't take time to write down the lyrics, I could play it for you, but I don't know if the music would blend in well. But of course, you can sure listen to it. Now, this is the racist God and creating nationalist money. It's very apropos to what's going on today. It was just posted today because of the possibility that if there is a civil war. It's written by Willali. Actually, it was March 6th, Monday. The racist God in creating nationalistic money. I have to admit that this is one of the most serious articles that I have written. We must be ready to fight under any kind of circumstances and throw away every fantasy about getting any kind of help from any kind of institution. When all institutions are controlled by globalist parasites, we have to start creating our own. After analyzing the current political landscape, I pondered the possibility of ending up in a civil war in which nationalists, abandoned from the police and all international institutions, have to defend themselves on the streets, face to face against black drug dealers and Arab gangsters, as is now the case in Greece. In this most extreme of cases, under a collapsed economy, we can succeed only by having a better organization. We would be witnessing the fight of one race against another, where only naked talent and superior blood play the decisive role without the intervention of Jewish anti-natural selection. But of course, it would be nice to avoid that. Nevertheless, we should hope for the best and be prepared for the worst. With a good organization, we have better chances in any possible scenario. One of the considerations that gives me strength to fight is to imagine that I am already dead. Without a white society, morality and life themselves have no meaning anymore. Everything is worthless. But if there's still some hope, one reason to be here is to fight for a white world. Only with a white world can beauty be born. Only then can the path towards divinity and the transcendental be traced. Let me say clearly from the beginning that this article is not intended to foster pessimism. On the contrary, once we have the right mentality and put ourselves to work, we have good chances for success. We should not overestimate the capacity of the globalist elite. Even with all the money they invest on the final enslaving of humanity, they have progressed rather clumsily and slowly. The results they get from investing $1 billion could be easily outdone by a modest investiture on people driven by love and passion. This is the case because the results that an intelligent but materialistic person who prostitutes himself for the best deal will always be mediocre in comparison with the results from a creative idealist who acts out of fanatic love toward his culture. The materialist has only intellect and lives to feed his ego. The idealist has a connection with the transcendental and has in his soul an insatiable hunger for improvement, which can only be calmed with the palpable beauty he creates. Personal responsibility. If I could summarize the essence of Hitler's administration, I would do so with the following sentence. We need personal responsibility in order to survive. And if there is something in common between Christianity, multiculturalism, modern democracy, communism, and capitalism, and all kinds of Jewish ideologues that end with ism, it is the lack of personal responsibility. One of the greatest weaknesses of humanity is the easiness with which we fall into promises of avoiding responsibility. Many white people profess the idea of equality because it is a way of avoiding the responsibilities that being the superior race implies. Isn't it much easier to be like that Negro or the Mexican who doesn't have to think about the future of humanity, about science, or keeping his blood pure? They envy their simplicity, but nonetheless are aware of white superiority. The best way of fooling ourselves and the world is to be white, but claim equality with other races in order not to do something challenging with our talents. Responsibility and gods. Monotheistic religions are also a way of avoiding responsibility. If Odin could have a few words about Jesus, he would say that he is an incompetent tutor. A real God doesn't give his love and help to anyone so easily, much less in proportion to how weak he is. A real God puts his believers to the test. And only when they have gone through real challenges does he help. A real God teaches responsibility, fanatic passion instead of mediocrity, and struggle. Only when the believer has succeeded on these tests comes from the transcendental, the magic that catapults our work and legitimates all those years of arduous struggle. Morality is the least of the concerns of a real God. A real God cares about creating beauty, selecting for more talent, and someone who jeopardizes these two in the name of morality could only expect damnation and scourge from the gods. Morality arises naturally from an advanced race. It is the cherry on top, a result of civilization and not the source of it. The Brehon laws of the ancient South show us this is the case. They had no moralizing gods and nevertheless had a sense of fairness to which only the Constitution of America came close. A good method to deal with this human weakness of trying to avoid responsibility through God is to imagine a God that is racist, a white supremacist. Think of any nasty label that the media puts on us in order to intimidate us, and think that this God wears these labels gladly without losing a single bit of as righteousness.
Komm, Tag, ja und ja, wenn ich durch diese Straßen gehe, sehe ich, wie die Ruinen dieser Stadt wieder zu Häusern auferstehen. Doch bleiben viele Fenster leer, für viele gab es keine Wiederkehr. Und über das, was grad noch war, spricht man heute lieber gar nicht mehr. Doch ich frag.
Most of you are already aware that the sick freaks ruling our world are engaged in some of the most horrific crimes against children imaginable. This dark and depraved underground is something any healthy person would not even want to consider. But we must investigate their operations and expose these criminals to the light of day so that justice might be done. The recent Pizzagate revelations are just the tip of a massive iceberg. Watch the big picture, Pizzagate and Beyond. Learn the terrifying truth at beyondpizzagate.com.